Andy Gunn and Rob Bertrand, two engineers at WAMU who put together the first combined system and master antenna for WAMU and other Washington, D.C. FM stations. It's a great story, and we'll learn a lot about FM combining into a master antenna coming up next on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Broadcast Bionics, with the Bionic Studio, including talk show control, social media, and visual radio, Broadcast Bionics brings exceptional audience engagement to radio and TV. By Angry Audio, audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by Max Connect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts.
Hey, before we jump into the show, breaking news. Just got this in from Nautel. Here's what's going on. They got a couple promotions, and Transmission Talk Tuesdays are back. So promotion number one, you get a free second backup exciter promotion. Now, you get a free second integrated redundant exciter on any GV series transmitter. Contact your Nautel rep or go to the website nautel.com/11things. That's 11things. nautel.com/11things. The other promotion is the 4610 VS Savings promotion. What does that mean? Well, it's three offers in one. You get $4,000 off the purchase of a VS 2.5 transmitter. Hey, I've got one of those. Love it. You get $6,000 off the purchase of a VS HD digital exciter. I'm thinking about that. I think we're going to do that. And you get $10,000 off if you purchase both. So you can add those two promotions together, $4,000 off of VS 2.5, $6,000 off the VS HD digital exciter, and $10,000 altogether. Contact your Nautel rep or go to nautel.com/4-6-10. Okay, maybe hard to remember. I'll put those in the show notes so you can click on those easily. Finally, Transmission Talk Tuesdays starts June the 8th. And every Tuesday, June 8th, 15th, 22nd, and 29th. So what you need to do is go to nautel.com/webinars. nautel.com/webinars. Register yourself there. It's easy to do. And once you fill it out the first time, it'll probably autofill itself. And you get an email back with the link, and it'll auto-populate in your calendar. It's just great. So check it out. nautel.com/webinars. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. It's our 548th episode. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. Delighted to be here and glad you could join us. We have got an exciting show today. Where we're actually going out on remote. We're going to take a trip out to a transmitter site and have not one, but two engineers are going to give us a verbal and a little bit of a visual tour of where they are. So without a whole lot of further ado, let's bring them right in. There they are. It's Rob Bertrand and Andy Gunn. Rob, Andy, welcome to the show. Great to see you both.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So Rob Bertrand, I've known you for some years. Did I meet you in New York City?
A number of years ago, yes.
Yeah. And so you are the chief technology officer at a big radio station. Tell me about that.
Sure. I joined WAMU as the head of technology in 2016. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was kind of where this project had its roots. To be honest, I accepted the job before I ever came out to the transmitter site, which is located on the campus of American University. And must have been my first day here that I came out here and I looked up at the tower and I said, oh, wow, it's a really special situation going on up there of a bunch of interleaved FM antennas. And the very next week was NAB in 2016. And I got the chance to meet my colleagues and tenant mates over at WTOP. And they gave me a long history of the nature of those interleaved FM antennas, of which one of them was theirs. And the seeds of this project were born. So it's been 5 years, and really excited to be sitting here in this room with Andy today.
That is okay. That is so cool. So you walked into a situation that was what, less than ideal with interleaved FM antennas?
It was certainly less than ideal. Back in the early 90s when this was built, these were all fundamentally different stations. WAMU was a little station playing bluegrass music. It ranked pretty deep in the ratings ranker. WTOP at that time was known as WGMS, I believe. And they were playing a commercial station playing classical. And while they did a little bit better in the ratings than WAMU did, they were nowhere near the powerhouse that they are today. WTOP, known for its all-news format here in Washington, was really just an AM signal. Today, they are really an FM signal, three FM signals, actually. And so these two stations didn't warrant the kind of investment that we just made. On top of that, there was a backup for another station, here in town, WPGC. Further down on the tower, Pacifica's WPFW was here as well. And then 102.3 at that time would have been known as, it might have been known as WMMJ. I'm trying to remember, and help me out, Andy, if you remember, the really famous Washington station. It was on 102.3 for a very long time. And they were moved here to the AU Tower sometime just before this. In any case, it was a very organic growth of stations on the AU Tower. There was a pole up on top of the tower. It was actually hit by a plane in 1974, which is part of the folklore of this place. And it was loaded with antennas, none of which were stations that really warranted a multi-million dollar investment at that time. And so they put these antennas up with the best engineering that was available at that time. I have a lot of respect for everybody who had contributed to this facility over the years. And today, in, you know, or in 2016, when we began this process, WTOP, you know, number one billing radio station in the country. WAMU, one of the top public media stations in the country, and routinely here in Washington, WTOP and WAMU trade places in the number one, number two spots in the ratings.
Wow.
So this tower is pretty important to radio here in DC, and the significance of this plant is much greater than it was in 1991 when all of those antennas were very creatively perched on the pole on top of the tower.
I want to hear more about that. And of course, 1991 was 30 years ago, right? So I would expect things to be the way they were. Anyway, hey, Andy Gunn, I want to bring you in and say hello. Welcome in. Andy, you are the Director of Engineering at WAMU there in Washington, D.C., and you're also an SBE member and highly certified.
That's right. And actually, this is my second time around at WAMU. I was here from 2009 to 2011 as a maintenance engineer, and I actually worked on the, you know, all of the facilities back when it was the series of interleaved FM antennas. And it certainly made tower work interesting, and running around and making sure that all of the transmitters were safetied out and nobody was going to turn back on while we had climbers on the tower. It was a little bit of a circus back then. And I came back a few years ago, and one of my first main projects was taking all those old antennas off the tower and putting on a new pole, the structural work, and, you know, coordinating with ERI and all of the subcontractors to renovate the tower and put on a new pole and antenna and build this combiner system.
You know, during the show today, we're going to get into a couple or three different ways that FM radio stations arrange their transmitters and their antennas, because there are different ways to do it, not necessarily a wrong way to do it, but when you get several stations together and it's in the same place, then combining starts to make sense. We're going to talk to that. We're also going to, part of the show, the early part of the show, we're going to give some fundamentals of FM transmission and what people do and how things tend to grow organically as a tower site maybe becomes a bit more valuable. I want to start with that idea. I've been to so many transmitter sites where it started out as one FM radio station on a tower. You know, one FM station has the tower built, they put their antenna on there, and that's fine. It's there all by itself. You know, the next FM transmitter isn't, you know, a quarter mile, 10 miles away, whatever. But then it turns out that, hey, another FM station will fit there. Maybe it's co-owned with the first one. Maybe it's a competitor. Maybe it's a non-aggressive competitor. You know, maybe it's a commercial station and a public station. And so we want to put this other FM antenna on the tower. Height is always good. Can we go to the top like the other antenna is? Can we have two antennas next to each other or in each other's aperture, as it's called? Or is there a way to maybe offset them a little bit so that what you don't want to have is the signal that's emanating really strongly out of one antenna get really strongly into the other antenna and go back down the coax and into the transmitter, into each transmitter, because then you'll have transmitters typically are a nonlinear amplifier for the output. And so when you have a main signal and you have a little bit of another signal coming into that as well, they can mix in a way that makes intermodulation products. And so what you end up with is you end up with signals up and down the FM dial that aren't supposed to be there legally, and they may exceed the legal limit of transmission, because even a small portion of a watt would end up being an illegal transmission in most cases. So there are ways around this, but this is where the problem starts. And by the way, gentlemen, I'm involved with a number of radio stations that are on tropical islands. And typically, you have a one-bay, maybe a two-bay antenna. You don't have any real estate to deal with. You have a building, and so people attach poles to the building like this, and they stick their one-bay on this. So you got 3, 4, 5, 6 radio stations all within 30 feet of each other, all transmitting, and nobody's got any filters, and it's just whatever comes out on the dial. So that's not a good situation. We're going to learn how not to do that. We're going to learn what are the better ways to get around that. If we could, before we take our first break, let's look at a little bit more of the physical tower itself. I did not know that there was a tower on the American University campus. Either one of you, kind of tell me about the tower. How was it? How big was it when they first built it? How big is it now? Is it? I gotta believe it's hemmed in. I mean, land's got to be pretty valuable right there at American University. What's that tower situation like?
So I guess I can start, and Andy, fill in details that I might miss. So it's really very unique because the tower was built in 1947 by the Evening Star Broadcasting Company, or Evening Star Publishing Company, which, if I'm remembering correctly, owned the Washington Post at that time. That is where the call letters WTOP come from. And so this was built to serve their venture into television. And they came to American University with the proposition of, hey, you've got some land there. We would like to build a tower to do this new television thing that everybody's talking about. And, you know, we'll tell you what, in exchange, if you give us some land to build a tower, we'll build you a building, because, you know, we're getting into this TV thing because we think it's the next big thing. And you could have a building that has a TV studio in it, and you could teach students how to do television. And that was the very beginning of the American University School of Communications, which is a major division of American University today, something that's really well known for. And that building started with the donation, or I'm sorry, that program started with the donation of the tower and the building in 1947. Fast forward to the late 60s, and you know, the population center, like most cities, was moving further and further out to the suburbs. And so this 419-foot tower was really not meeting the needs of serving the most far-flung suburbs. And there was no way that they were going to be able to build a taller tower on this property. In fact, they went to the FAA proposing a taller tower here, and the FAA said, no. You're too close to Reagan National Airport. You cannot build a taller tower. And that went on for several years. And they did eventually leave and join forces with another couple of stations and built a tower in another part of the city, a couple of miles from here, that's much taller and not quite as directly in the Reagan National flight path. So what to do with this tower that they no longer needed? They did start their experimental FM station at that time, which, if I'm remembering correctly, I think was called WTOP. I think the TV station was called WTOP, or today it's called WJLA. It's the ABC affiliate in town. But what to do with this tower that was no longer needed? They donated it to the university, and that happened in 1971. And just a couple of years later, on a very foggy day, while WAMU was broadcasting beneath the tower, a small private aircraft flew into the tower, and ultimately was destroyed, and the passengers they did not survive. There were folks who were pretty concerned about the FAA's determination of you not being able to build a taller tower in this crash happening just a couple of years after that. But we're glad to report that there have been no near aircraft misses since that terrible tragedy in 1974. But that's a really unique, I mean, there's so many unique facets to this tower and the story of the tower. And that's kind of the beginning of where WAMU factors into it.
Is that tower still 419 feet tall, or have there been changes since then?
Same height.
It's the same height. And Andy, I don't know if you know this offhand. I didn't think to bring a drawing here. So I said it was 419 foot tall. It would have been a little bit shorter by, I don't know, maybe it was 400 feet tall. Mm-hmm. That's an extension was added later in the 80s to accommodate WPGC, but it was approximately 400 feet tall.
Andy, Andy Gunn, if you don't mind, could you bring us up to date from from that time? What happened in 91 and where things stand now with that? I want people who are our listeners and viewers to have a mental picture of what this tower is like or what it was like before the project that we're talking about on this show, so we can have a real clear picture of what it was and then the project and how it is now.
Sure. So it's a four-sided tower, so it's square at the base, unlike many towers that are triangular. It's sloped. It's a lattice tower, so it has cross members running across it. The lattice portion tapers up to about 370 feet. About 340 feet, excuse me, where the pole section starts, and then from there, there's about 80 feet of pole. And prior to the most recent tower work that we had done, the pole was tapered. It had, several sections that stepped down and got smaller and smaller as you went, which was fine from a structural and a loading standpoint, but not necessarily fine from an FM propagation and re-radiation standpoint. The antennas had to be tweaked a little bit to be on a stepped pole like that, because it was, it's not consistent diameter going the whole way up. Over time, about 1991, the stations that Rob had mentioned earlier were all on the tower at that point, and changed call letters slightly over the years, but have stayed consistent throughout that time. Over that period, of course, cellular communications grew and cell antennas were added to the tower. A few years ago, the tower project became a twinkle in Rob's eye, and he started to talk to ERI and design this project, or talk to a number of manufacturers, I should say, about revamping the tower, redoing the pole, putting up a community antenna on the tower, and several years later, we're here.
So prior to this project, did every station on the tower have their own antenna?
Yes, they did. WPFW had a side-mounted 10-bay antenna, which is pretty big.
Yeah.
And because we're on a college campus, we had to worry about radiation exposure into the college dorms, which are just a few hundred feet away. Mm-hmm. So some of the antennas had to be specially designed so that signal shot over the top of the dormitories, and we didn't have high exposure in those areas. And it was very carefully designed just to prevent those things. And antennas were added to the pole over time. And as Rob mentioned before, they're interleaved. So WAMU and WTOP's antennas actually overlapped, which from a frequency standpoint was fine. Each antenna was tuned and had tuning sections so as to reject the other signals. But it still wasn't ideal. Anytime tower work had to happen, you had to shut everybody down. Everything was kind of messy up there. There were a lot of line sections running over each other, line sections running inside other people's antennas, so on and so forth.
You started to say how you kept one signal out of the other. Was there actually detuning or done at the antenna end, or was it all done in filters at the bottom, or were there even filters? Because the tropical islands I'm talking about, not many people install any filters that they should put in there. What was your situation?
So we actually don't have any filters, or we didn't have any filters at the site. Mm-hmm. Each antenna was carefully tuned so as to reject the signals of the other stations. That doesn't mean that there wasn't intermodulation being generated between the various stations, but it was low enough that it wasn't causing any interfering signals anywhere on the dial. So everything, as a station got added, intermodulation studies were done. Spectrum analysis was done, and each station was determined to have been safe to broadcast.
By the way, when you had these individual antennas, did each station maybe have a backup antenna?
WAMU had an auxiliary antenna on the side of this tower, and actually WETA, another public station in the area, could use that antenna as their auxiliary antenna. And so, you know, we shared that antenna on the tower. But other stations had auxiliary antennas on other towers in the area.
When I got one more question before we go to break, and that is, so when you had all these different antennas on the tower, was there any just recurring nightmare? Was there any problem that just wouldn't go away, that this is the main reason we're going to go to a combined antenna system? Was there anything like that?
Rain.
What would happen?
Every time it rained, one tenant in particular, I don't want to name who it is because I don't know if they would feel comfortable with that, but one tenant in particular, they their antenna suffered from water. It was not quite the same grade of antenna that WAMU was using, so we didn't suffer from the same problem, but they would often trip off. And for them, that was the biggest reason to do this project, was that, you know, when it rained, they would experience high VISWAR, and sometimes it was so high that the transmitter would back all the way down to zero. So this was the biggest driver that I can think of. Andy, I don't know if you are aware of others.
Well, I thought we were also at capacity on the tower in terms of loading. Mm-hmm. So we weren't able to add any more antennas or any more stations, which, you know, in a market like Washington, D.C., you always want to be able to allow other stations to join your tower, to have auxiliary sites on the tower. We just didn't have any more capacity. The tower was maxed out. So we had to either redesign it or remove antennas in order to get more load capacity.
We are talking to Rob Bertrand and Andy Gunn. They are the CTO and the DOE, Director of Engineering, respectively, at WAMU in Washington, D.C., at American University. We're talking about a tower project, and we're going to get to the equipment but they're not in a brewery. They're not in a microbrewery. I know it looks like that, but there's not beer in the canisters behind them. There's RF, and we're going to talk about what the design phase, the implementation phase. And before the show is out, gentlemen, I want to talk about, you know, how do you get other broadcasters, some of them competitors, to agree to do this? How do you, you know, do you form a new corporation, all that kind of stuff to do a combined antenna? And then how do you, you know, make room for, let's say, somebody else wants to come on board? What kind of expenses would that be? But the technical stuff is coming up in part two with Rob Bertrand and Andy Gunn. I'm Kirk Harnack on This Week in Radio Tech. Our show is brought to you in part by our friends at Broadcast Bionics and the really clever Camera One system. We'll be right back.
Camera One from Broadcast Bionics. Designed to bring video to your audio content. Visualizing radio and podcasts for social media. Camera One can automatically create, capture, and brand professionally switched video for live streaming or upload, making your production shareable. Control and configure using a web browser on any device. Camera One is available as a 4-camera or 8-camera system, using the Blackmagic A10 Mini range, including the A10 Mini Extreme. You can use cameras to suit your studio and your budget. You'll need one camera for a studio wide shot, and usually one camera per microphone. A standard multi-channel sound card or IP driver monitors audio from each studio microphone, and we work natively with Axia systems. Ideally, this will be a post-fader feed from each mic, although you can use pre-fade audio or a mic split if that's all you have available. These audio levels are used to intelligently switch the video feed when each contributor is talking. You can also group microphones together into one shot and use the audio from a mixer's aux bus. You can use Camera One's auto switch feature, or disable it and switch using the on-screen buttons or the buttons on the ATEM. Recordings can automatically start when you tell the system you're on the air. This on-air indication can be linked to your studio's red lights via IP or an Avantech Atom GPIO interface. You can quickly browse all the videos that have been automatically created during your broadcast, download them, and post. Camera One is a user-installable system. You'll need a good-spec Windows 10 PC, i7 with plenty of storage, and 16GB of RAM. It's better if this machine isn't used for anything else. Remember, you can control the software in a web browser on another device on your network. Camera One, a thrifty way of creating scroll-stopping video from your show or podcast from Broadcast Bionics.
I like that. A thrifty way, and it is clever. You want to see more about it, go to bionic.radio, bionic.radio. Thanks a lot to Broadcast Bionics, and that's not all they make. They make lots of clever, clever stuff to make your broadcast better and to really get your broadcast involved in social media. That's what they really specialize in, to make great content for social media and engage your listeners and viewers even more. All right, I'm Kirk Harnack on This Week in Radio Tech, talking to Rob Bertrand and Andy Gunn, and we're talking about a project where they combined a bunch of FM antennas. If you've been in radio engineering any time at all, you know that you can't just take the output of transmitter A and the output of transmitter B and tie the wires together and send that up the antenna. It just doesn't work. Transmitters are notorious for not getting along with each other. Each transmitter wants to believe it's the only one there, and it doesn't want to be bothered by anything else. And that's the easy way to do that is to have an individual antenna. Have your transmitter go feed an antenna and try to, keep other antennas out of the way or away from it so that your transmitter believes that its antenna is the only thing that's out there. It's all by itself. It's king of the hill. But that's not the practical situation, because we have a tower in a densely populated area and people want to be there. So we've covered the way the situation has been, and a little bit of the impetus as to why to change to a common antenna. Rob, let's talk about let's talk about the process of actually getting going. You said you talked to a few companies. You apparently settled on ERI. What's the design process like? What are the considerations when you're going to put up a community antenna?
Well, in the case of this project, this had been going on for so long. There had been more than 20 years worth of different iterations of this. I actually didn't even know that when I reached out for the folks at ERI and at other manufacturers. Later on in the process, the sales rep from ERI said, this is like the seventh time I've quoted this project, because, quotes are free. So they keep asking for this. Are you really going to build this? And I think we are. And so before we even got into the design process, first we had to demonstrate why we could do it. And that was really what kept, why we could do it from a business standpoint. And that's what really kept us from being able to build this for so long. And so before we really got too deep into the design process, we did an initial design so that we knew roughly what it was going to cost, which changed exponentially over the course of the project, as projects often do. But first, we needed to convince the university that this was a business that WAMU could be in, and that it was something that wasn't going to cost the university money. And that meant that not only did we need to convince other broadcasters to come and join the project from a technical standpoint, but we needed them to join from a business standpoint as well. And so our most key partner in this was WTOP. And they split the cost of us of all of the common parts of the system that were not structural in nature, that were not essentially anything that wasn't related to WAMU potentially being able to make money from it later on. WTOP split those costs with us. So they were a major partner. And, you'd asked about what is it like for competitors to come together. That was a major leap of faith. As I mentioned, we are number one, number two in the market. It would be to both of our advantages to not work together and for the other to be in a subpar broadcast space. But that's not how we think here in broadcast most of the time, I like to believe. Certainly not here in broadcast in Washington, a place where people sometimes have a hard time getting along. But we are really, really grateful for our partners at WTOP and their business commitment to this is what really enabled all of it.
Well, this brings up a question, because I've heard of other community antennas. The people involved, or the major players involved anyway, the ones who are going to be either all the co-owners or maybe the landlords, they get together and they maybe form a separate corporation. If there's something you can't disclose, that's fine. But how did you guys come together on a business basis to be able to, I guess you're probably a landlord to some of the people who are there, right? And then you're partners with with others. How did that work out for you guys? What worked for you?
So there's a lot of layers of detail there that not all of which I think would be necessarily appropriate to get into. But I can say that we did not form a separate corporation, that the system on the whole, the antenna and the tower are owned by WAMU and American University. And of course, that's a big consideration from the outset, being able to convince somebody else to make a big investment in something that they are not necessarily going to own. So it means structuring the deal in a way that makes sense for them, that gives them certain rights and priorities as being a stakeholder in that system. All the broadcasters own their independent combiner modules. So the equipment that you see behind Andy and I, that is owned by each broadcaster. And so that is the physical asset that is owned by each broadcaster. But the antenna system itself is owned by WAMU. You mentioned that we know each other from New York. And I spent a number of years helping to care for the brother of this system on top of the Empire State Building. Much larger system, much more complex business arrangement up there. So I had a little bit of experience thinking through this process. While I didn't build that system, I was part of the team that helped to keep it going amongst the community of 16 broadcasters that were located on that system. And so we took a lot of learning from that into this project and worked with the broadcasters and the attorneys and the real estate people and, of course, our partners ultimately at ERI being the successful vendor who ultimately was selected for the project, and it was quite a team effort across the board.
Maybe Andy would like to answer this or speak to this. I'm curious about the technical parameters now. What information do you take? What do you give to ERI or whoever's going to design the combining system and the antenna, the master antenna? What do you tell them so that they can start writing things down and putting numbers into spreadsheets and computer programs? What do they need to know?
They mostly need to know what's on your FCC license. So your frequency, your effective radiated power, and that's about it, and the height at which your current antenna is located at. And so they take all of that and they crunch the numbers and determine what model of antenna will work, whether you're an omnidirectional or a directional pattern. In our case, WAMU is and WPFW are omnidirectional, and WTOP is a directional signal. So the manufacturer, the vendor, has to actually figure out, okay, if we're going to put everybody into one antenna, some signals have to be directional, and these are the patterns by which they need to radiate at. And then we have these omnidirectional signals, and that all has to work in one antenna. And so does it have multiple inputs? How is the antenna array phased such that everybody exists happily together? And they take all that and they determine the right antenna, the right combiner, the right type of combiner modules, the size of the lines, and then they hand you back various numbers, including how much transmitter power you would need, how much floor space you'll need, so on and so forth.
Oh, now you just brought up a topic that I had no idea existed, that you can directionalize some signals on a master antenna while keeping others omni.
Really one at a time. So our antenna is a series of panel antennas that have two crossed antenna elements. Mm-hmm. And there's a right-hand polarization and there's a left-hand polarization. Mm-hmm. One is omnidirectional and the other is directional. And so all of the omni signals go into the left-hand polarized elements. And WTOP, the directional signal, goes into the right-hand elements. And that is what allows that side of the antenna to be phased such that it provides a directional signal.
The elements that are on the tower, are these what they typically call a cogwheel type of?
Yes. It's a cog. ERI calls a cogwheel. Yeah.
How many levels of bays do you have, and then how many around the tower?
It's three around and four levels. So it's really 12 elements, or what would be a four bay, three around?
Gotcha. And would this be full wave spaced or something other than full wave spaced? Well, of course, it's going to change depending on frequency. So they've got to kind of compromise and make it fat for that.
I don't believe it's full wave spaced. I'd have to actually look that up. That's a good question.
Well,
stump me.
Yeah. Well, full wave spaced might imply more downward radiation and more upward, right?
It is, yeah, it's not full. In fact, I forget what the spacing is at 88.5. I almost want to say it's a weird number, like 0.6 or something like that. But it was enough of a change as we were looking at those downward radiation figures that we had to go to a much higher TPO for WAMU. So it was really a heartbreaker because we had just bought a new transmitter.
And that wasn't quite big enough?
Yeah. And it was just barely not big enough. So that transmitter is now our aux. We can do full analog power with it, but we cannot do full analog plus minus 14 HD. So we were the ones that took the hit, and it sort of felt appropriate for the landlord to be the one to take the hit there. But so that everybody else, we were really facing the biggest downward radiation issue with WTOP. So to minimize that, we brought the bays closer together, and that was where it didn't work out quite as well for 88.5.
Okay. Going up the tower, do you have more than one coax or rigid line carrying power up there, or does it all go up one pipe?
So the combined omnidirectional signals are all on one 6-inch hard line. It's on 6 1/8. And WTOP is on its own 3 1/8 heliax.
6 1/8. That's a big honking hardline. How much? Yeah. What's the total power going up each one? Do you know?
Usually the stations that are on all the time, omnidirectional, is about 50 kilowatts, and WTOP adds another 20 to that, so that's about 70. And then with auxiliary signals, we could go up to about 90.
So this brings to mind, speaking of auxiliary, what about a backup or an auxiliary antenna if your big new fancy four level antenna needs service? How do you stay on the air if you had to do something to it?
So we actually have an auxiliary antenna on WETA's tower in Arlington, Virginia. Excuse me, that'd be a little far away. And so we have an agreement with them that they can use our tower to broadcast an aux signal, and we can use theirs. So in the event of an emergency, we could go to that tower.
Okay, so does that imply that any of the broadcasters on this master antenna, if they want a backup, that's not a community project. That's on their own, right?
We unfortunately don't have space for another main antenna on the tower. So all the other broadcasters have other sites that they either have for other stations, or they have other contracts with other towers in the vicinity.
It's interesting what stations do to, first backup or second backup. I mean, I got a station in Hawaii. Again, it's got a two-bay antenna, but it's right near lots of other two-bay antennas. And, we can remote control. We can put on a different transmitter, which goes into a different antenna. So we got backup there. But if all that fails, if the power goes off on Mount Kahili, which it often does, we actually have a one bay on the roof of the building. We don't cover, nearly as many people on Kauai, but at least we're still on the air. And so stations, you can put an antenna on your STL tower if you need to, as long as it's licensed as an aux. So, wow. Technical parameters. Let's spend just a couple more minutes on this. Tell me you're in the combiner room, and I've never dealt with a combiner more complicated than two inputs and one output, and is pretty off the shelf and pretty easy. That's a very custom job behind you there. Which of you would like to give us a little bit of a tour as much as you can on that?
I'm probably better positioned. Let's see if this doesn't cause any motion sickness.
Oh, that's perfect. Perfect.
So we have four main combiner modules behind me, and they're set up in an array. So each one feeds into the next, and each station, has their input into that combiner module, and they're constant impedance combiner modules. So they have a signal input, and they filter out all the other signals in the system, and they feed power down the 6-inch line to each to the next module, which passes it. Due to the nature of the constant impedance filter modules, the other signals just pass right on by, and each input signal just adds along as you go down the chain. And so we have WTOP has an omnidirectional input to the system as well. That's a backup input for them, which is at a lower power. We have WETA's auxiliary input. We have WPFW right behind me. Mm-hmm. And then we have WAMU's input over here. We actually have fans on ours because, as Rob mentioned, our power had to go up. And our power is pretty high, and those cans get pretty hot if you don't have some active cooling on them.
So technically speaking, why do combiner cans, why do they get hot?
Just resistive heating. You have, when you put 31 kilowatts through anything, it's going to get pretty hot. And so even though they're made of aluminum and copper, which have very good conductivity, you still have a little bit of resistance on the skin of the inside of the cans, and they just get hot.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And I would imagine they may be rejecting, you know, they're passing sufferings, but they may actually be dissipating the things that they're not passing, right?
Can you angle your screen up?
I can try, I think.
You have a decent shot there.
See if we can get it. Each station, you can somewhat see it. Let's see if I can get it right. Up there, you can see a reject load for each set of cans. And that is taking the signals from each adjacent station that makes it through the filter and rejecting it.
Okay, and so that's actually going into a dry load, a dummy load. And are those, I saw some maybe sensors up there, are those metered? You can see how much power is going into the
Have pretty extensive metering on the whole system. So we worked with Burke to design an Arcturus system that would monitor both forward and reflected power on all of the inputs and outputs on the system, but also our dehydrator pressures, our line pressures, temperatures all over the system. So not only the reject loads, but actually some temperatures on each set of combiner modules, as well as other points in the system, the room, HVAC exhaust. Mm-hmm. So we're monitoring quite a bit.
Wow. We got to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to ask a little bit about safety, because this is not just you. There's other people involved, and any of the other parties involved could cause a problem for somebody else, maybe without knowing it, without they're not trained well. And I'm sure you've got some systems to try to keep that from happening. We got to talk about safety. It's This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. It's our 548th episode. We're talking to Rob Bertrand and also Andy Gunn at WAMU about their combiner system and how that came to be and what it ends up looking like. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by our friends at Henry Engineering. Hank Landsberg just develops the most amazing products that you need to make things, to finish your radio station, to finish your broadcast studio. And this is one of the latest ones. This is the Henry Superlight. You know, the Superlight, what it is, a lot of us have used the Henry Super Relay. Remember that? The Super Relay? Well, the Super Relay was that box where you give it a contact closure, and it's got a bunch of relays that move, and it had a power outlet on it that would come on and go off. So if you turn your mic on, your on-air light would come on outside the studio. Well, the Superlight is a logic and control interface, but it's for controlling low-voltage studio tally lights. Because nowadays, you build a studio, you're not going to put a 110-volt bulb in the light outside the door. It's going to be an LED fixture. And so you can run low voltage studio tally lights with this. Even the lights that are like on the microphones that some of them have. You can directly power 12 volt DC LED tally lights that draw up to half an amp, up to 500 milliamps. The Superlight does include a flasher circuit, just like the original Super Relay, as well as a double pole, double throw relay output that can be used for any low voltage switching. You can mute speakers with it if you need to. You can mute a telephone, for example. You got a phone that rings. You can bring that ringer wire out and mute that if you don't have another way to do it. Remember the old days when we used to tie the cassette deck capstan motor to the relay? So whenever you turn the mic on, you'd leave the cassette in record, assuming mechanical keys on it. When you turn the mic on, you'd start that cassette motor. Well, okay, you can still do that if you want to, but you're probably doing it some other way. But the Henry Superlight will do that kind of thing as well. By the way, if you need to sync more than half an amp of LED current at 12 volts, you just apply an external power supply. It'll sync up to 2 amps of current. So you can have lots of on-air lights and run lots of lighting if you need to and make that work with the Henry Superlight. Also, you may see that it's got these RJ45 connectors on there. Now, these aren't what you would call smart. In other words, these are passive, but inside are little programming jumpers, and you can daisy chain several super lights together so that you can provide contact closures and hit the right one. So let's say you've got a row of studios and a hallway. You can easily just daisy chain from one to another, or maybe you've got these boxes actually in your rack room. You can daisy chain from one to another, and it just reduces the amount of wiring that it takes. Instead of basically wiring in a star fashion, you can wire in a daisy chain fashion and just set the address with the jumper in each one of those. You know, Henry Engineering, Hank Landsberg, makes all kinds of cool things for your radio station. They still make the Henry Matchbox HD, the Twin Match, the Multiport, also the Digimatch, the USB Matchbox 2, which has a USB interface, the Multiport, the USDA 2x4. So many of these things that you have come to know and love and depend on, even for sports broadcasting, like the Talent Pod, the Sports Pod, the Sports Caster, which is a great little mixer, and even headphone systems like the Multiphones Mini Pod, the Stereo Switch, the AES DigiSwitch, and so many, many more things. You need to check out the website, henryeng.com, henryeng.com for Henry Engineering. And when it comes time to actually buy one of these, you don't buy it directly from Henry. They're a manufacturer. Go to Broadcaster's General Store. BGS.cc is the website. But the best way to deal with Broadcaster General Store, I find, is give them a call. 352-622-7700. 352-622-7700 for Broadcaster's General Store. They'll answer the phone right now. They're there. They're waiting for your call. Call them unless you're watching this in the middle of the night. I mean, they are real people. But they'll answer the phone and really help you out. Broadcaster General Store and Henry Engineering. Thanks a lot for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. All right, we're back with Rob Bertrand and Andy Gunn. Safety. What can you tell us about keeping other users or yourself safe with this thing?
Well, go ahead, Rob.
No, I was going to say that there's a few layers to that. Andy mentioned the Arcturus system. That's a big part of it. And I will actually let him talk more about the Arcturus system. Really, really proud of the Arcturus system. And I want to also just, you know, really point out that Andy made the Arcturus system in conjunction with the folks at Burke. Into the system that I have always dreamed of for a master antenna system. So I just did, because he won't, you know, give himself those props. I will let him talk about it in just a minute. It is the most well-implemented master antenna monitoring control system that I have encountered. And so really, really proud that that's part of what we do here. You know, in terms of brute force safety, let me see if I can do this without causing motion sickness or unplugging it.
You're fine.
We've got this this patch panel over here behind me.
That's pretty.
And this it is pretty, which is really why we wanted it. just the pure aesthetics of it. But these U-links come out just like you would remove a patch cord from a patch bay in a studio, if you remember those. You know, this handle, which I will not open because that would shut the station down through the Arcturus, through safety switches that are there. I can pull this handle, which releases a safety switch behind it, causes an interlock to open that shuts the transmitter down via the Arcturus. Then we can remove these U-links. Each one represents a given station. And then we have the ability to move feeds around for a couple of different maintenance purposes over there. But that's sort of the brute force part of it. And then there are some more elegant ways that we maintain safety and continuity in the system as well, which I'll give Andy the chance to talk about.
Andy?
Right. So I mentioned before that in the Arcturus system, we're monitoring a lot of points, including the patch bay, including forward and reflected power. And so when you talk about safety, there's a few levels there, right? One is safety to any climbers that are on the tower, anybody that might be working on a system that needs to be shut down. So we have a few ways that we can disable systems and make sure that they're off. The brute force method is guaranteed. If you remove a U-link, that antenna is not going to be activated. But we can also shut it down in software. or with a key switch. So the Arcturus system we designed to have dual interlocks sent to each broadcaster's transmitter systems. That is driven by individual lockouts. So we can go into a user panel and disable a station, or we can disable every station on the tower. We can also turn a key switch if it's an emergency and you just need to shut people down without dealing with a web interface, essentially. You can go ahead and do that. We also have VSWR protection on the system. So standing wave ratio protection. If, say, the antenna malfunctions, say we have high icing on the antenna and we get a lot of reflected power back down into the system, that can damage transmitters, it can damage the combiner system, it can cause a lot of problems. And so Arcturus is monitoring the reflected power of every station in the system. And if anybody's reflected power creeps up, it will essentially open the interlock and tell that station, oh, your reflected power is too high, you need to shut down. Now, it has to be really, really bad for it to get that to that point. But it will also do a three-strike system. So maybe there's just some malfunction that is reset by removing power from the system and waiting 60 seconds and reapplying. It will try that three times. And if the VSWR is too high after three tries, it'll leave the system in lockout mode. We can reset that lockout so that everybody can go back on the air. But that's really to protect your equipment. I mean, some of the transmitters that we have are significant investments, and you don't want the transmitter to be damaged in a high VSWR event.
I am, whenever I see a combiner room, and yours, I haven't been there, but we can tell by the shots you've gave us. So I'm used to installing a transmitter and a rack in a room that's big enough to where, you know, if it had to go 6 inches one way or another, or a foot here or there, there's always enough, you know, overhead room. Typically, you may have to move a piece of coax around or put an elbow somewhere. Point is, without a lot of planning, you can install most transmitters in most transmitter sites. But it looks to me like you got to plan that thing almost down to the millimeter, or at least to the centimeter, where everything is going to go. How does that work out between you and, say, ERI, in terms of the dimensions? It's got to fit in this space, and they say, no, it won't fit in that space. It's got to have this much space. What's that process like to plan that three-dimensional installation?
It's wild. So our shelter was built by VFP Shelters, located in Virginia. I'm trying to remember what town they're in Western Virginia. They were really wonderful to work with. Would highly recommend them again. We are actually sitting beneath the tower. So this building sits, as Andy mentioned before, this is a four-legged tower, which is a little uncommon. It's a wide-faced tower. We are sitting underneath the tower. This little shelter is situated beneath the tower. It is tall enough to accommodate these combiner racks standing up. You can see that we have just enough clearance to get those reject loads. I think that we're about 10 inches below the ceiling there. We gave ourselves just enough space to be able to get all the lines in place. But we worked with our structural engineer to get a footprint of the building. I mean, it's pretty remarkable that we are within 6 inches in some dimensions, between the building and the tower. We wanted to maximize our space as much as we possibly can. And then ERI worked with us in a three-dimensional CAD program called BIM to, actually model out what this combiner looked like. And I think we were at that stage just as Andy joined us at WAMU. And I was running around the office like somebody who had just had a baby, showing people like, look, not only is this in 3D, but you can spin it around on the phone. We finally, after all these years, arrived at a point where this baby was three-dimensional and you were able to see it in all of its glory. And, Andy came at just the right point, because that was really when the heavy lifting began. And that was, we prepped this building you know, not only did this finished literally days before we had to start focusing on COVID and remote operation, but we had the building built and in place in the middle of the height of TV repack. And so managing the manufacturers and tower crews and all of that through all of TV repack when things were at such a premium was just a really, really significant complication to this process. So we had this building built about a year in advance. It was the spacing and design for that was managed very carefully between our structural engineers and ERI and VFP. And there was a lot of going back and forth between all of those vendors to make sure that all of it would fit and hopefully that we'd have a little bit of room for expansion in the future.
Yeah, I was going to ask about things. Well, we've talked about expansion. If could you accommodate another radio station if one? I can't imagine a station shoehorning in there from an allocation point of view, but could you?
Well, yeah. I'll tell you that from a financial standpoint, we are welcoming tenants who might want to open an auxiliary facility on this tower. But if they also wanted to relocate their main, we are ready to welcome that business. But actually, there's a couple of stations that we know would perform very, very well from this facility from an auxiliary standpoint. And so we're hoping that as opportunities arise, that we might be able to lure them here. Thankfully, Washington, D.C. is a major broadcast market, of course, and it is one of those places in the country where it makes sense to have geographically diverse auxiliary stations, even in 2021, as streaming is becoming, you know, an increasing source of delivery for many of our listeners in these markets, you know, especially in the legendary traffic of Washington, D.C., even during COVID, we are still, you know, seeing a lot of people listening in vehicle and, you know, FM coverage for those listeners is really, really important. So, in this day and age, not everybody is building geographically, diverse auxiliary sites. But Washington is one of the markets where there are still a few stations that don't have them, and we would welcome them with open arms to this wonderful facility.
We're going to run out of time, so sadly. If one or both of you could give me a quick idea of what is commissioning like on a system like this, what are generally speaking, you get it installed, you get all the plumbing done. What do you have to do in terms of the knobs and the adjustments and who does that? I guess ERI, but you guys tell me.
Yeah, we worked very closely with ERI throughout the process from design and install and testing and commissioning to make sure that all the components of the system were well-tuned and working well. So ERI sent an installation crew. They worked with a local tower rigging and erection company here in the region to do the structural work and install the antenna, run the lines and all of that. And so they worked very closely with that company. And when it came time to commission the combiner system, they brought their own technicians out. They put everything together very quickly, actually. They're very talented at putting everything together. And then they went system by system, and by system I mean a combiner module, tuned it, adjusted everything so it passed the most signal possible from every broadcaster, and then also rejected signals from all the other stations. So they went one by one and tuned each module, and then at that point they also tuned the antenna to work best with the combiner system, and they actually inserted slugs of a special type of ceramic into sections of the line such that the line provided the best match between the combiner system and the antenna that gave us the most broadband signal possible or the most broadband antenna possible.
Wow. We're going to take our last quick break here, and in our final segment, we're not going to have much time, but I'm really curious about ongoing maintenance. But if you have something that you'd like to, that would supersede that the answer to that question, please feel welcome to express it. But I'm you know, what do you have to do to take care of a system like this? Does it take care of itself, or just what? This Week in Radio Tech, our 548th episode of Kirk Harnack, along with Rob Bertrand and Andy Gunn at WAMU and their fairly new combined antenna system. Our show is brought to you in part by our friends at Angry Audio. Don't get mad, get angry. This is the Angry Audio headphone gizmo. And yeah, you know, I know I make a joke about this, but you won't snag your pantyhose on this headphone amplifier. This hangs right under your audio your countertop, and you screw it in the bottom like that. It's got little rubber feet on it to keep everything quiet. It won't sit there and rattle. And it's got, you know, both kinds of headphone jacks on it, 1/8-inch and 1/4-inch headphone jacks. Nice headphone knob right there. And on the back, it is the Studio Hub wiring standard. So it's got left and right analog audio balanced, and it's got a way to insert power. So you can insert power on one of these and then daisy chain it to other headphone amps, or you can use a Studio Hub power supply to insert your power there. You can daisy chain these and carry audio from one to the next to the next. Of course, adjusting the volume on one doesn't affect the others downstream. Everybody gets their own volume control. And Angry Audio, they have totally bought Studio Hub. They own Studio Hub, and that means you can get all of the usual adapters and dongles and things like that from Angry Audio. This is an original Studio Hub adapter, a cable, and these work just great. You know, they actually went to a lot of trouble over the years to develop the tooling and the techniques for taking a stranded audio cable and getting them into an RJ45 connector. That is not easy to do reliably, and they certainly have done that at Studio Hub now with Angry Audio. And then here's the male version of that. It's got the male RJ45. So these are very useful for wiring up things like audio over IP systems, where your audio inputs and outputs on the back are typically going to be on RJ45 connectors. And they work either for analog or for AES EBU audio. And you know, the last thing, I've been talking about it for such a long time because it's so helpful now that a lot of us are broadcasting from home, and that's the Bluetooth audio gadget. Just pair this up with your phone. You can get phone calls in and out of your audio console because there are jacks on the back to go to your audio console. And you can also play high quality audio out of your phone and into your audio console through this Bluetooth. And it automatically knows the mode that you want to use to provide the right codecs for each type of operation. Check it out. AngryAudio.com is the website. And when you talk to your dealer about buying any Angry Audio equipment or Studio Hub gear, be sure you tell them, no, I want the real Studio Hub stuff. I don't want the knockoffs. I want the stuff that's been around for a long time and has a lot of engineering that has gone into it. So check that out. This Week in Radio Tech is also brought to you by my friends at Max Connect Wireless. Here's Gary Morrill.
I'm Gary Morrill, Midwest Regional Director of Engineering for Alpha Media. When I first spoke with Josh Bone about Max Connect, he told me they'd work great for remote transmitter sites where connectivity was a challenge. And you know, he's absolutely right. We even have sites where we're using this as a backup to our STL using Max Connect's dual carrier option, and it works perfectly. We also have times where we need to be able to get out to a venue where it's kind of challenging because everybody and his brother is trying to stream video at the same time, like at a big sporting event. And you know what? Our data gets through every time because it's prioritized packet data. It works for us. It'll work for you. Max Connect. Check it out.
Gary's got that one. I've got the PepWave 4G LTE modem that is on Max Connect Wireless. And of course, the modem is not the important thing. What's important is the SIM card and the Max Connect Wireless service, because you get prioritized data. You get prioritized out of all those other jokers that are at the parade or the ball game or where the breaking news event. And you get a fixed IP address. See, there's mine right there. Fixed IP address. No matter where you plug this in, you've got the same IP address anywhere. So you can address it and the equipment behind it remotely. You can set up the little router. You can poke holes in the firewall if you need to. Check it out. MaxConnectWireless.com. Thanks a lot, Josh Bone, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right. We have just got a couple more minutes to go here with Rob Bertrand and Andy Gunn. So, gentlemen, what do you like to talk about for the final few minutes of our show?
Good question. Well, you mentioned maintenance. I think really quickly, one of the things that we've tried to design into our Vizwire monitoring system, Arcturus, is actually some predictive analytics. And we worked closely with Burke on that so that we would get trend data over the course of a year. So we would see temperature trends, power trends, both forward and reflected power on the whole system. We also have designed in some redundancy to our dehydrator system, so that if one dehydrator fails, a backup one takes over relatively automatically. They also cycle between each other so that the load is even across them. So we've tried to do a lot of that so that if we see any problems happening, we can hopefully see them coming. And we also, we'll need to do inspections with ERI over the years to make sure that the system is performing correctly.
Mm-hmm. Rob, do you have a final comment for us or some parting thoughts about this kind of system?
You know, I will say that ERI was really a fantastic partner in this. We're really, really proud to be sitting in this room today and everything is clean and together and functioning and doing really, really well. And I wish I could say that that happened after day one of commissioning. But like any complex project, it doesn't always shake out that way. There were actually a number of iterations that had to happen to get us to the state that we are sitting in today. And that's probably another show in and of itself. But I really, really want to commend everybody at ERI, and especially the commitment of Tom Silliman, the president of ERI, for ensuring that the right system ultimately resulted from this project. They worked really, really hard to get this system right. Today, it is the coverage that we're all enjoying from this new antenna and from this combiner is terrific. It is a major improvement for all of the stations. And it didn't happen by magic. It didn't happen overnight. It happened by a lot of hard work and commitment from everybody who was involved. And certainly the greatest of all of those people were the team at ERI. So just really want to give them a shout out for not just delivering a great product. It didn't just, you know, come off the truck and go perfectly, as, you know, complex things rarely do. But they stuck with it all the way through to the end, all the way through the complexities of COVID as well. And the ultimate system that resulted is something that we can all be proud of and depend on for many years to come.
Would I be wrong in when I think about stations that are combined? And I've been to several transmitter sites in big cities where you've got a number of stations going up the pipes and into a master antenna. And the impression I get is that in such a system, just by the very nature of a number of shared tenants going into it, that this system receives more maintenance and thought and care than perhaps an individual station's antenna that, you know, look, I'm not proud to say, but at my stations, you know, the antenna gets thrown up, the coax gets run up, we hope it doesn't lose any nitrogen, and we don't think about it for a long, long time unless there's a problem. And when you've got a system like yours, the ones that I've seen, people do pay attention to it, they check on it. Of course, there's you know, some maintenance items, there's safety things that make you pay attention. Would I be wrong in thinking that you actually pay a lot more attention to your transmission system when you have a combined system?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot more riding on it. You know, well, yeah. So I'm really proud of everything that evolved here. And some of those things, like many things in life, you just learn from either doing it wrong or having received the wrong things along the way. You know, the largest version of this system out there is on the Empire State Building. It was the first of its kind of this particular type and this particular antenna. The system that's here today is actually very, very close to the newer system that is installed on the Empire State Building as the auxiliary system. Mm-hmm. They're almost identical, although this one is, of course, smaller. And, you know, there were things that happened over the course of the decades of service of that system where we learned lessons in New York. And we learned, hey, wouldn't it have been great if we could have seen this parameter over the course of a long period of time and have watched it? So, you know, for example, as Andy mentioned, there's some predictive analytics in Arcturus. We have a one-year strip chart where we can see all of the most critical parameters of the system and look and say, that's interesting. There's a spike there. That wasn't there this time last year. And so we can track all of these parameters through the seasons and see, like, all right, what's going on here? We really believe that this system is going to be very successful for these broadcasters for a long time because of that attention that it gets. And then, of course, you know, in today's day and age, everything is IP addressable. We get email alerts for everything. We have a tremendous dashboard here in this building, but there's another dashboard in our studio that, not literally in the studio, but in the control area where our technical personnel sit, where just every day we walk past that screen and we see what's going on. We didn't have that when we had a single antenna. There was, you know, it was just one station on one antenna.
Yeah.
We might have monitored the pressure on that. And that was not all stations do that. So, you know, kudos to us for looking at the pressure. we look at so much more today. And yes, it's because it's complex and there are a lot of things riding on this.
Andy, any final word to wrap us up?
No, I think Rob got it.
Good deal. Good deal. Gentlemen, we're out of time. I think I could talk about this another hour or two, but, you know, and we could, you know, over a dinner or a beer sometime. So we should do that. Rob Bertrand, the CTO, Chief Technology Officer at WAMU, and Andy Gunn, the Director of Engineering at WAMU. Thank you so much, both of you, for talking to us about this and for letting us in a little bit on what most people don't get to see, a combiner room and talking about the whole project. So thank you so very much.
Thank you.
All right. Rob Bertrand and Andy Gunn, appreciate you guys. I'm Kirk Harnack. I want to put a big thanks out to our producer, who is Suncast. Thanks for taking care of all the lower thirds and the publishing for us. Thanks also to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network, where you'll find other great podcasts right here at the GFQ Network. We'll be back next week with another episode of This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.